My name is J.C. Hall, an alcoholic.
Hi,
everybody. Really grateful and glad to be here. I was looking at that little baby, and I was just thinking about my grandson, and it just brought back a lot of warm, you know, thoughts. You know, just sitting there looking at that baby, and I was just thinking about my grandson, and I hope I get into that a little bit more later on. You know, I'm glad to be here. I've never been to Nashville before, and I left Atlanta this morning and got on the airplane. I left about 10:05, I believe. I arrived in Nashville at 10:05. You figure it out. Are you going to call somebody and tell them, say, what time did you leave? So I left at 10:05. So what time did you arrive? I arrived at 10:05. They start thinking you're losing it again. Now, I got off the airplane, and I had talked to Tim on the phone, and he said, I'm going to be the one to meet you. So I was looking for a fella. From his voice, I was looking for an older fella. So I come off the plane, and I'm looking around, and I don't see anybody with a sign or anybody, you know, making any gestures. And I see this one old fella, and I said, God, that guy, like, he's been through some things. It's probably him. So I'm going to stand over here near where he is, and sooner or later he'll spot me, you know. And sure enough, this young, pretty girl comes up and says something to him, and the two of them walked off. I said, well, maybe that's not it. Finally, this fella, I hadn't seen these three guys standing over there on the far side of the deal, but, you know, I just didn't, you know, figure them to be it. So finally, one of them walks up, and I suffer with sinus problems, and sometimes the plane gives me trouble, and I can't really hear, especially when I first get off the plane. I can't hear that well. And this guy walks up to me, and he says something. I'm not quite sure what he said. And so I said, what did you say? And he said, J.C. And I said, oh, yeah. He said, well, I'm Charlie. I said, hey, Charlie, how you doing? So I was glad that they were there to meet me. So now we go, and we're going to get us something to eat. So we get over to the Cracker Barrel. Now, this is where the fun starts. Mark and I are sitting with Tim and Charlie at the Cracker Barrel. And they've got two different menus on the table. So I pick up one menu, and Mark's got a menu, and we're looking, and we've read back. And we're looking at all this stuff that's on this thing. And I said, well, Mark, what are you going to have? Mark said, I don't know. He's looking at it. I said, well, I'm not quite sure. So we're just sitting there mulling it over. And about that time, Tim tosses each of us a 20, and he said, that's your meal money. Eat as much as you want or as less as you want, but that's it. Then he makes the big announcement. We're not sure you can get in your room. We're probably going to have to hang out for a while. So we started seeing the great city of Nashville, and it's quite a beautiful city, and I enjoyed the sight. I got to see where the red light district used to be. That was of quite of interest. Brought back some fond memories. Mark and I got to talking. Now, you got to be quick to catch this one. We figured we're going to get in our room. And Mark said, J.C., I believe we can charm them into giving us our room a little early. Now, here you go. It's Friday evening. J.C. and Mark walk into the hotel. It's on. I walked up to the desk and I said, good evening, God said, down. Lady said, well, what's your name? I said, Jay-Z. And I said, that's Mark. They checked us right in. But I quickly let her know we had limited funds. And we didn't need to spend it all in one place. So go easy on that hotel room, Rick. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a lot of gifts. And as I stay sober in this program, you continue to give me more and more gifts. My sobriety date is May the 1st, 1984. For that, I am grateful. My home group is the Tri-City Group. We meet at the St. John's Episcopal Church in College Park, Georgia, on Hardin Avenue.
Hey, brother.
How you doing? All right. You know, I got here on an airplane today, and one of the, I used to would not get on a plane. In fact, some years ago, my sponsor spoke in London, Ontario, and he was flying. And we drove 18 hours to get to London, Ontario. Went up there and turned around and came back on a Sunday, 18 hours, all the way back. And I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and this guy named Jack Sullivan, a lot of you probably know Jack, and Jack looked at me and I was telling him about this fear of flying. He said, J.C., well, you know you're still working, and you're getting to go to more and more conferences, and you're going to have to get on the airplane. Now, at my home group, there was a lot of ex-pilots, mechanics, and everything else, and none of them could convince me to get on no airplane. And here's a drunk that used to sleep in a cardboard box. Made me promise that the next flight I had over a certain number of hours or miles, I can't remember exactly which one it was, that I would get on an airplane and fly. And so I got on, Valerie and I were scheduled to speak in Evansville, Indiana. And so I told him, I said, well, she said, how are we going to go? She said, you promised Jack Sullivan we were going to fly. I said, I don't care what we promised Jack Sullivan. I'm not getting on no airplane. So she said, well, come on, you know, it'll be okay. And I got to thinking, you know, I had promised Jack that I was going to get on the airplane, so I did. We got out to Hartsfield, and I'm looking around like a kid in a candy store. This thing is just exciting. I've never been in the airport, you know, to do anything like that. And so I'm looking at my ticket, and I keep trying to figure it out. It's American Eagle, American Eagle. And I'm looking at all the planes, trying to see which one it is that we're going to get on. So I asked Valerie, I said, well, Valerie, you going to get something to eat? And she said, well, I'll just probably get a little breakfast on the plane. I said, well, okay. So as we were walking on down through the concourse, now Valerie has flown quite a bit, and I'm looking, and I finally spot it. And I said, oh, no. I said, Valerie, if you get something to eat on that plane, it's going to be in a brown paper sack. So we flew out of Atlanta into Nashville, caught a connecting flight into Evans, Indiana, and believe it or not, we got on an even smaller prop plane to go to Evansville. But a drunken Alcoholics Anonymous convinced me to do that. One of the things that I have learned, and some of you who don't know, my profession, I'm a City of Atlanta police officer. And a lot of times when I'm at work and stuff like that, I always have my defenses and my guard up. And you know, I found that since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm in these rooms, I have no defenses and I don't have those guards up like I did when I was when I'm at work. In fact, I called one of the people that I sponsor, and he told me, he said, "Well, where are you?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "What street are you on?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "All I can tell you is that I'm about a day's in Nashville, Tennessee." I said, "Let me look around the room and I'll find something." And I said, you know what, that's not quite so unusual. I said, remember we used to go to Macon and all these other places, and people would ask us, complete strangers, and say, would you like to go to a meeting? Sometimes we'd be down in Macon, Georgia at the State Assembly, and people would ask us, say, would you like to go to a meeting? And we'd say, yeah, we'd go out there and get in a car with somebody we've never met a day in our life before, to go to a place we've never been to before. We'd pull up in a dog alley behind a building, and we'd go in this building with people we've never seen. And it's okay. it's absolutely okay, and we trust that it's okay. We never even ask questions or even think about it. And so, you know, when he asked me the question today, you know, that's not quite so unusual. You know, that's the way we do things. And we were talking about the fellowship of the Spirit. The other gift that you've given me is the privilege tonight to meet Cecil. 16 years ago, when I was struggling to make this program, my sponsor gave me three things. He gave me a big book, he gave me himself, and he gave me a lot of tapes. And I own one tape with that man's voice on it. I've never met him in person before tonight. And the message that he had to share with me on that tape 16 years ago helped to put me in this program. For that I am very grateful. And I want to thank you for the privilege of allowing me to meet him today. You stay sober long enough in this program, you get to experience some of the good things. And that's just one of the things that has happened to me since I've been in this program. You know, I was a strange kid growing up. I always had strange thoughts, strange ideas. And I told you, I'm not married anymore, but I called my ex-wife and told her that I was here. Every time I still go out now, I call it just habit. I say, well, I'm in Nashville. And she says, you know, that's good. And, you know, whisper. We're friends today. We're still friends. A lot of people don't understand it, but we are very good friends. We parted in a good way. And but I, you know, I called and told her that I was here. And, you know, one of the things that when I was dating Valerie, I was trying to convince her that I was the one that she should have. And what I did was I told Valerie that my people were not from Earth. I told her that we had been dropped off here. We were aliens. And we had been dropped off here many years ago on this planet, and we had been living amongst Earth people, and Vara was just tickled as hell to have the only alien on the block. I mean, she really believed it. And you know, every now and then you got to come up with a better deal. So then one day I told her, I said, well, I really didn't tell you the real truth. I'm not really an alien. That's a cover story. Really, I'm in the black mafia. And we'd be walking down the street, and it'd be some total strangers on the other side of the street. I don't know these people. And I said, don't look back. See them guys over there? She said, yeah. Don't look back. Don't look back. Those are my bodyguards. They're here to protect us. And I even gave them names. I mean, I told them who they were. And God, she just be walking along with a smile on her face. And, you know, everything was just wonderful. You know, I convinced this lady to marry me. And we started setting up not a marriage but a booby trap that destroyed the lives of a woman and a man and two children. And I can tell you tonight that there were some good times. There was a lot of good times. There were times when we would go out and we would meet people and we start having card parties. And at these card parties, there'd be a lot of drinking and a lot of music playing. And I don't know about y'all, but you get some beer, some liquor, and the music get to playing and the hormones get to racing. Boy, that's a good time. And we had some good time. We had these roving card parties. All my friends, we would go to each other's house every weekend. And we'd have these card parties. And we'd sit there and we'd drink liquor and have a good time. But when the parties would be over, I don't know what would happen to me. But I'd become angry. And those were the times when Valerie and I would fight. I can tell you many times when my children and my wife would run out of the house at night and they would be afraid because they didn't know what I was going to do. I can tell you of a time when this woman would put her head down and run into a wall like a bull charging a matador. And she would continuously run into this wall with her head until she would knock herself out because she didn't want to get hit anymore. I can tell you of a little girl who drug a rag doll around in the house, who had the saddest of eyes, and she didn't talk to people. She didn't have much to say. I can tell you of a little boy who stole a $10 roll of quarters. And when he had this $10 roll of quarters, I said, "Boy, why did you steal my money?" And he said, "Dad, I didn't steal the money to buy me no toys or to buy me any cookies. I stole the money to buy me some friends." I can tell you of a time when plate glass windows would get broken out because I would have come home drunk and the fight would have been on. And the people would come to fix the plate glass window, and we would say that one of the kids ran into the plate glass window with their tricycle, or they hit it with something, and we would blame it on the children. The children would sit there with their little eyes and look at us. I can tell you of a time when a shot rang out and Valerie shot me. And I remember the police coming. And I was sitting in the back of the police car, and I remember Valerie's mother, as she walked past the police car, and she looked over there at me, and I saw the hatred in that woman's eyes. And I can remember the police officers as they were running to the apartment where we were living. And as they were trying to surround the apartment, I saw Valerie running from window to window, and she was peeping out, and she was, I guess, trying to see what was going on. They were converging on the apartment because one of their own had been shot, and they were going to get her. And I was sitting up trying to holler, "Don't shoot her." And I remember on the ride in the ambulance to the hospital, looking at the guy in the ambulance and feeling so ashamed. So very ashamed. Before the next Saturday was out, I had gotten drunk again, handed her a .38 pistol, got one of my own, and said, "Go for it." We lived like this probably 10 years before we ever found you. How did I get in this shape? When I was a little boy, my daddy used to like to drink liquor. I never wanted to be like my daddy. My daddy would go crazy when he would drink. My daddy would bust up all the furniture in the house and he would do crazy stuff. I remember times when my mama would have my brother on one side and me on the other side, and she'd be running down the street and she would be afraid because my daddy would be busting up the furniture and putting it in the fireplace, and we would see the fire blazing up out of the fireplace. And I didn't want to be like my daddy. I remember a time my daddy hit at my mama with an axe, and they could not get that axe up out of the step. They had to remove the whole axe in order to get rid of it. And my mama left my dad, and she came to the big city of Atlanta, Georgia, and she left me and my brother down in a place called America's Georgia. And down in America's Georgia, they had some strange stuff going on. One old boy down there was named Booker T. Booker T made homebrew. And what Booker T would do to get future customers, I guess, he would give all us kids a mason jar, and we would sneak up there. He would give us some for free, and my brother and myself would sneak up there because he kept it in these milk churns outside of his house, and we'd sneak up there and steal all that we could drink. And then they found me laying one day out in the middle of this bag of cans, and I was laying there And they thought I was, I guess, sick or something, because my eyes had rolled back from my head. They took me to the doctor, and the doctor took one with me to take that boy home. He just drunk. I wasn't even 5 years old. Finally, we came to the big city of Atlanta, Georgia, where my mama was. And I remember we got a phone call one time that said, J.C. Hall is dead. Now, we had gotten a phone call like that before. And we got to America, Georgia, and J.C. Hall was alive and well. And all hell broke loose out of America, Georgia. But this time it was true. My dad had been run over by a train. And a funeral director in America, Georgia had no compassion for two little boys. He exposed my father's nude body in the condition in which they brought it in. You see, apparently somebody they think had shot my daddy with a shotgun and laid him on the railroad track up there. And this man sat there and told us how they had to fight the dogs to take back part of daddy. And they sit there and he showed us my daddy's body. And I remember sitting there crying. Because, see, that wasn't just my daddy laying up on that table. You see, I had forgot about all the mean things that my daddy had done. Clancy says it's called dynamic memory. We can't seem, after a while, to recall the pain. And I was sitting there not thinking about the bad times. I was just thinking about, you know, if I could get back to where my daddy was, my daddy would love me. And now he's laying up there on that table, broken and mangled. And nobody's going to love me. I remember being in Atlanta, Georgia, staying with my stepfather at the time. And this man, like my daddy, used to drink. And this man would take entire hands to doorknobs, and he would beat us with electric cords. And I can remember being angry, and that's why I kept wanting to be with my daddy. You see, I forgot the stuff that my daddy did. I figured if I can get back to where my daddy was going to love me. You see, I forgot all the mean things he used to do. I just kept looking for a way out. And I remember when they buried daddy, it was raining that day in that Georgia clay. And they put a flag over my daddy, and I knew my daddy didn't deserve that flag. You see, my father had been dishonorably discharged from the United States Army. Primarily for drinking and being crazy. They kept saying my daddy was shell-shocked. I never heard that term before, but they said, J.C., he was shell-shocked. He was all right, good fella, but he was shell-shocked. My daddy drank liquor. And when my daddy drank liquor, my daddy went crazy. And when I was in high school, growing up, you know, I had tried that religious stuff. I used to go to church when I was little, and I'd get down on my knees, and I'd be at an altar like this. And I remember they brought this lady in. And I thought this lady really was close to God because of the things that I saw her do. This lady would put oil on her hands, and she'd lay it on people, and she'd paint a cross on your head or whatever, and people would fall out in the floor, and they'd get to jumping and hooping and hollering and speaking in tongues and doing all kinds of stuff. And she'd come by me, and she'd put that oil on me, and absolutely nothing happened. And I was, you know, it may not have meant anything to anybody else, but, you know, at the time, I really wanted God in my life. When I was down at that altar, and they said, Terry, for Jesus, I really and truly meant it. With everything in me, I wanted what those people had. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but whatever it was, I wanted it. Because I saw this lady put her hands on people, and they were in wheelchairs, and they got up and they walked. I saw people foaming at the mouth, and stuff was coming out of their mouth like foam, and she said they were casting out devils. And then I remembered that while I was down there helping clean up the church one time, I stole some money out the pool box, and I went next door, and I bought myself some cookies. I said, that's it, God must hate me. I must be a child of the devil because God won't have nothing to do with me. And that's quite a heavy load for a small child to carry. one Sunday, this lady was preaching, putting that oil on folk. Hell, I don't know why I did it. I went outside the church and beat up her son. He was standing out there, a little fat rascal, and I just whipped him. Just seemed like the thing to do. And you know, people always talked about my cousin, my step-cousin, Larry. Larry was going to be a bishop, and Larry was going to be this, and Larry was going to be that. And it was always Larry. And then they look over there at J.C., and J.C. wasn't going to be nothing. So I always believed that I would be nothing. So here I am. Married. In a relationship with somebody. With all that stuff. The only solution that I knew was to drink. It was the only thing that ever made sense to me. When I drank, I could be anything I wanted to be. And I remember that. I didn't know how to be no husband. But I used to watch them Burt Lancaster and them Kirk Douglas movies and them John Wayne movies. And man, I tell you, I knew how to imitate them guys. You know, and I knew how to be bad. You know, I figured if you can be bad, man, the women like bad guys. You know, because I had tried the good guy thing. I had been going to all these different churches and stuff like that, and it just seemed like it never worked for me. Every time I ended up in a church, I ended up with the people that were drinking liquor. Shoot, I was in one church one time, and the choir director, and I would go drink Wild Horse and Vanya wine, we'd get drunk, have a good time, talk about all the hypocritical folk in the church. We would play Isaac Hayes music and burn incense. And have those black light posters on the wall. And one of them, some of them deacons came over there one day, and they poured out all our wine and told me that it was not a proper place for a young man to be. But they didn't understand. You see, at my house, there was people that when I was sleeping in the night would come up and choke me in my sleep. There was people that when I'd be out playing basketball with other kids in the neighborhood, this guy would run up behind me and hit me in the head with a brick. And I hated this man until one day I went and got a .22 pistol. His .22, he had went to pick my mama from work. And I got his .22 pistol. I had made my mind, I'm going to kill this man. I felt there was no way out. And so when he came back, when he walked in the house, I was standing there angry with that .22 pistol. And I cocked it. And I was going to shoot him. But he used my mama as a shield to try to get close to me. And the closer he got to me, I knew that I was even going to have to shoot my mama and then shoot him. And I didn't want to shoot my mama. So somehow or another, I was able to get around him, run out the door. Now again, I tell you, I like watching them TV shows. When you're on the lamb, you got to toss the pistol. So here I am running down this rocky street and all these bushes. So I, you know how they toss it in the movies? I tossed the pistol. I had enough money to get a bus and went down to America, Georgia, and stayed with one of my relatives until I thought things had cooled off. I kept waiting for the police to show up to get me. They never showed up, so I figured I was on the lam. And finally, my mama called and told me to come home, and I went back home. And that's what that lady married. That's what was a father to two children. No skills, no nothing. All I knew was in a bottle. You see, when I drank, it could be anything I wanted to be. And for a while there, it seemed like everything was okay. And then the problem started setting in. You know, we would be broke. I knew every finance company in town. I owe finance company and knew them so long I watched them change names. You know, they send you things and we've changed our names. I can remember going into pawn shops because I had a little .38 pistol. And I was standing in the pawn shop and I tried to pawn that pistol so we can get some food for the house. And I remember, if anybody's ever pawned anything, understand what I'm fixing to tell you. The shame and the degradation when you know that you need the money. And the guy sits up there and the way they talk to you. The way that they talk to you. And then you scrape up enough money to go back and pawn it out, and you do it all over again. And I remember there being more beer liquor in my house than there was food for my children to eat sometimes. And I remember going to the thing, and sometimes the lights would get cut off. And I would have put a note on the meter saying, I'm going to pay this bill such and such time. And I went down to Georgia Power office, and I raised holy hell. Didn't you see the note that I put on that meter? I told you I was going to pay that bill. Man, those people don't have a sense of humor. You know they put that stuff in the computer? They type that mess in the computer. And I was down there raising hell about the bill. Then I said, I put it on the... And then I started doing all kinds of stuff. You know, I didn't know how to be a father. You know, there were times when I needed money for my children. I needed to have, you know, buy some shoes or something like that. Let's just say I had $10 and the shoes cost $12. Well, because I didn't have them other $2, man, I sit up there and I cry. I get to feeling all sorry for my stuff and I take the $10 and go get drunk. You know, it solved the whole deal. Then we start meeting people, and these people had boats and houses and all this kind of stuff. You know, we didn't have none of that stuff. But we felt like we did because we were with them. They were important people. And I was running around at the nightclubs, 2001 VIP club, the disco, hot tomato. Man, I walk in with my suit on. I have a fake diamond ring on. So they pull myself together, sitting up there smoking my cigarettes at the bar, and I was it. I was the it, trust me. I would sit there and tip good and drink good. You know, there's a lot of fears in this program, too. I always felt like I didn't ever have enough food, I didn't have enough this, I didn't have enough this. I always felt like I was going to run out of something. Or never too much did, but I always just felt like something was going to happen. And if I had a woman in my life, mainly a wife, I always thought I needed some spares. You know, in case this ain't working, this, and then in case that's not working, this, and in case that's not working, this. So I was not honest. I was not honest. Showing up sometimes days later, they're not knowing where I've been and what I've been doing. Sometimes I didn't know. I remember getting drunk when I got drunk one time and ended up in the back of a car. I don't know how I got in that car. I don't even know whose car it was. I woke up and I'm in the car with some people. And we ran down the road. I passed back out. And sometimes the next day or so, I got out of the car. I don't know. But I mean, but that's just the way it was. I ended up, I would be down on what they call the Strip, down on Peachtree Street. And the Outlaw Motorcycle Gang used to drink at a place down at on 10th Street, back on the back side of 10th Street. And man, they used to start up some fights down the hill. I'd be right in the middle of them. They'd get to fighting, and hell, I'd be fighting. Everybody'd be fighting. Another place down there called the Bowery. I enjoyed being in that booger too. All these were them low light places. And if you ain't figured out, that was the red light district. They had one place down there called the Lighthouse. And they had these piranhas in this big old fish tank. And they used to say, if you could stick your hand in and get something out of there without your head eat up, you get so much something they would give. I can't remember what it was. But you know, I used to sit there and look at that tank. I'll leave up fast enough to get it. Thank God I never drank enough to try it. But I used to hang out at Piedmont Park. I used to do all kinds of stuff, just having a good time, I thought. No responsibilities, not responsible for anything. Just seemed like life was just floating along. And with all the stuff that was going on, it was always Valerie and them kids' fault. You see, Valerie didn't understand me. And them kids, they did not understand. You know, they were asking for stuff. And they wanted me to be a father, and I didn't know how to be no father. I didn't know how to be a husband. I didn't know how to be anything. And then all of a sudden one day, something happened. The tables were turned. And I found myself sitting on the edge of a bed with a .38 pistol, and I was going to blow my brains out because I felt I had enough. This was it. I can't go any further. The pain and the hurt was too great. By this time, we had tried counseling. We had done so many things, and nothing had worked. And when you have a flair for the dramatic, you want this great demise to be witnessed so that everybody will know the story. And what do you do when you witness? Jump up and run off in the middle of the night. Hell, she runs out. So I would go after her. And I found out later that she's in the battered woman shelf, and now trust me on this, a drunk is cunning and baffling and proud. They are not supposed to give out the information about no battered woman shelf. Do you know I talked to her in the battered woman shelter? I talked to her. I was able to convince those people that it was worthwhile to let her talk to me. And she talked to me, and she came home. But she went over to mom and dad's house first. Of course, you know, they didn't sit well with them. Boy, they were mad. Everybody was mad. The jig is up. So I know. Got to do something. Got to get it fixed. I always knew. You got to get it fixed. How am I going to fix this? I know. We're going to go to counseling. So we go out here. This guy told us to go out to Bronner Psychiatric Hospital. So we go out to Bronner Psychiatric Hospital. And hell, I told him the truth. I told him what Valerie had done to me. Man, that woman needed to be committed. She was in bad shape. She was not right. And so the lady looked at me and she said, Mr. Hall, I think that you're stressed. We need to keep you. I said, oh, no. Now I got to get out of here. I got to get out of this deal. So how am I going to get out of here? So I told him, let me go home and get a pajamas and a toothbrush. I didn't use no toothbrush, and I didn't own a pair of pajamas. But I figured out that'll get me out of there. We went to the bowling alley, got some fried chicken from somewhere, ate the chicken. I got some beer, and I got to drinking that beer. And we were sitting out there bowling, and I was not happy. I'm mad. I'm mad all while I'm out there. So now we go to Valerie's mom and dad's house, and I'm telling her how rotten the situation is. And I remember this lady screaming to the top of her voice, JC, I can't help you. Okay, so I go back and check in the nut hospital. Now everybody gonna know what y'all did to me. Everybody gonna know that y'all drove this wonderful, loving human being into the insane asylum. They gonna know what y'all did to me. So I'm sitting in the insane asylum. And they got all these folks sitting up in here talking about they Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I don't want none of that. But I'm sitting here in this hospital where my life is in shambles. My life is in absolute shambles. And I still don't get it. These people talking about my sponsor's coming to pick me up and we're going to a meeting. I said, man, these are weird people. Those people were weird to me. And I just kept looking at them. I kept listening to this stuff they were saying. I said, man, what kind of grown people need other grown people to come and pick them up and take them to a meeting? It don't make no sense.
And I just kept talking about going out on the boat fishing with my boys and, you know, going to the 2001 VIP club. And finally, one of them ENA girls came up to me. She said, "You keep talking the way you talking, you ain't going to never get out of here." So time to change tactics. Well, I can switch with the best of them. I started telling them folk in that hospital, them women would come by there and them men come by talking about charging me. I said, "Let me talk to you. Mark, I understand, but just where I was at that time. Let me explain something to you. I know you look like you've had a hard day today." And they started telling me about their husband problems, their wife problems, their children problems, and I ended up talking to them rather than them talking to me. I mean, that's just the way it was. And then on Sunday mornings, I have all them nut patients sitting there in front of the sofa. We had a little room where we met, and I have all them sitting there, and I'd be sitting on the sofa, and Jimmy Swagger would be on, and Jimmy would be singing and crying, and I'd be singing and crying, and I said, "Don't cry, Jimmy, the money's on the way." And I... I would deliver the message to them nut patients, and they thought I was wonderful. People were giving me their numbers and their addresses and stuff, and they wanted to make sure when I got out and they got out that we'd all meet up somewhere, and they wanted to continue this thing. In the midst of all this insanity and craziness, I got a phone call that said my brother was wanted by the police, and he was facing 30 years. This brother had been my favorite brother since my other favorite brother had died. You see, I had another brother that I was real close to. Me and him used to drink liquor together and go to them low-light places and do some things. And at 17 years old, he died in the United States Marine Corps. But here was another brother, and he and I were hanging out together. And I was in the hospital, and I wasn't there to protect him. And he was in some bad trouble. And then I got another phone call that said that my mother, at 51 years of age, has succumbed to a massive heart attack. And by the time they let me out of that hospital and I went down there to Brady Memorial Hospital and I saw this lady in all the dignity facing death comfort everybody who walked into her room. And all I could do was hate. All I could do was hate. And my mama died that day. And when I got home, sitting on my doorstep was a plant. And it said from the psychiatric patients at Brunner Hospital. You see, even though I was BSing, those people really cared. Didn't take 30 more days and I was in another hospital. Again, I was in there because I was stressed out, and I met a woman in that hospital. Her name was Eleanor. And Eleanor was walking around there, and she kept saying, "Well, hell, if you get the liquor and the pills out of them, then you can tell what kind of animal you got." What a weird, that lady weird. Weird. I met a man in that hospital, his name was Homer. They tell me Homer has never put together not one single year of sobriety. He had been around Alcoholics Anonymous at that time for many, many years. But he looked at a young man in desperation, talking about all the things in his life. And he listened to all the stuff that I was spouting out, and he listened to all the hatred, and he listened to all the things that I was saying. And he was the first person to ever look at me and say, "Do you ever think you have a problem with alcohol?" And I said, "No." And I told him about the 2001 VIP club and drinking at all the rich and nice places. I didn't tell him about the nights of crawling across the parking lots in my police uniform, throwing up on myself when I was drinking MD-2020, Annie Green Springs, Boone Farm, or whatever. I didn't tell him about drinking the London Dry Distilled Gin. I walked in a liquor store one day and bought a big bottle. The guy said, "You trying to quit drinking?" I said, no, why you ask? He said, because hell, that's the closest to tire cleaners you're going to get. I he didn't understand. Shoot, you get a big old bottle of that stuff. It was pretty cheap. I mean, for a little money, you get a big bottle. But that's where my life was at. That's where my life was at. And this man spoke to me in what we know as to today as the language of the heart. And because of his sharing with me, I have not, since that day, found it necessary to take another drink of alcohol. And for that, I am very grateful. I started my journey in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was not an easy journey. I came in here very angry and very PO'd and not wanting to be here. I still thought the problem was Valerie. And if Valerie would just get straightened out, I can go back to 2001 VIP Club. And about 90 days sitting at the Tri-City Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard what I needed to hear. I finally knew what the problem was and who had the problem. And deep down inside, I knew that I was going to have to be the one to do something about it. And those people would stand outside of those meetings at night. Sometimes 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, they would listen to a young man spout off about anger. And they would take a boy and a girl and a man and a woman over to Shoney's. And they would buy us a hot fudge cake and a cup of coffee. And they talked to us. And when the bill would come, they never let us pay the bill because they knew where we had been. They knew we didn't have any money. My sponsor took my boy and my girl and got them in a football league. We didn't even live in the county. He knew we had never done anything like as a family. He had listened to my story. He had listened to me. He knew where I was at. And he got us involved in this football thing. And we went out there, and my boy lost every game. They lost every game. But boy, we cheered and had such a good time. And my daughter got a trophy because she was a cheerleader. And we had such a wonderful time. They were helping us to become a family. You see, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon gave us the gift of love. They did something for us that nobody had ever done for me in my entire life. I always thought I had to be good and then you would accept me. They took me just like I was. No reservations. They loved me with all the pain, with all the hatred, with all the insanity, with all the things. I had nothing to give. I had nothing to offer you, and you gave me love. If anything in this program warned me, it was the love in your eyes and the laughter. Those were the two things that broke me into this program. But I still had an ego. My sponsor's brother was a Georgia AA delegate. He was sponsored by a man who had been in Alcoholics Anonymous named Joe Phelan. Joe Phelan had come to Georgia some years ago, and he had God knows how many years of sobriety. I think if you lit a match near him, he'd go up. But Joe had been sober for a long time. And he was sponsoring the Georgia AA delegate. And the Georgia AA delegate was sponsoring the current DCM. And the current DCM was sponsoring the GSR of my group. People, if you ain't got it yet, I had a straight shot to the top. They were running around there talking about washing ashtrays. I ain't washing nobody. That's what? You need to wash these coffee pots. Yeah, okay. At 6 months, I think it was 6 or 8 months in the program, they let me chair my first meeting. I cried like a baby. Because they gave me some responsibility. And you see, I had been washing them ashtrays and washing the coffee pots. They began to teach me service. My sponsor used to always tell me, go get me a cup of coffee. You know, once, you know, in the beginning of the deal, it don't matter so much. But, you know, you get that little 6 months under your belt or whatever, you know. And you're going around the meetings and people patting you on the back, saying, you know, I really like what you say. Keep coming back. You know, is JC going to share tonight? You know. Sometimes I just pass. And then they come after the meeting, they say, why did you pass? So he was asking me to go get him a cup of coffee. I said, why don't you go get me one? Woo! I knew I was in for it. That man looked at me and he said, I was wondering when you were going to get around to it. You see, I've been wondering something. When have you ever done something for somebody without expecting something in return? And he hit me right here. You see, that's what people in this program gave me. They gave me the truth about me. And when I did my 4-step, and then when I sit there with my sponsor and I did my 5th step, he looked at me and he gave me the key. He unlocked the door. He said, you never have to be this way again. And when you had as much shame and as much stuff in your life as I had pushed down in mine, for somebody to sit there and tell me that my life can be different, it was like giving me a new freedom. And I said, what have I got to do? And he took me through the rest of the steps. And he told me something. He said, JC, I'm not going to sponsor you by my opinion. I'm going to sponsor you by the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first 164 pages is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I should die, if I should get drunk, if something should ever happen to me, you will always have the book. Little did I know, at 17 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he got drunk again and he left. To this day, he still has not found his way back, but he never lied to me. Because of what that man told me, because of what he shared with me, my life is rich today. I've had to face a lot of things in this program. I've gone bankrupt. I went bankrupt in this program. I lost my wife in this program. And I've been able to face it all with dignity. At 5 years in the program, my name came up for promotion on my job. And I was going to get promoted, I thought. And they said, Muir, we remember. And then this one guy, he said, you know what? This guy was the chief of police. And he said, you know, we know what he did. But I've heard some things about him. I think I'm going to give him a chance. I was the only person of the people that was promoted in that group was given what they call a 10G. That means go see the chief. And when I went to see the chief, I was shaking like a leaf on a tree because, man, I knew I must have done something really bad. And I walked into his office and he said, young man, I, this morning, decided to make you a sergeant. In fact, all you need to do is sign the pay order. And he shook my hand. They sent me to the worst zone in the city. I was sitting there, people were talking about, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to such and such. They said, oh, good. I said, where are you going? Well, I'm going to such and such. Well, great, man, you're going to enjoy that. Where are you going? I'm going to zone one. Oh, Lord. Make the best of it. I encountered men and women. That place was a dumping ground for people that really had problems. And I started telling them young men and women about some principles and about integrity, about the things that you were teaching me. This program says practice these principles in all our affairs. I can tell you that two of the people that came out of that group of people received the highest honor that my department can offer. I can tell you that today, since that time, I'm going to speed this thing up, since that time, those same men and women are now sergeants, detectives, and some of them hold the same rank that I hold today. They are lieutenants. And it's all because you told me to be honest. And you told me to live my life a certain way. And somewhere in the middle of that deal, I forgot. Because I started feeling the pressure of trying to live a certain type of life in that environment. And I had people filing grievances on me. I had all kinds of things going on because I just didn't believe in, I see something wrong. I just didn't believe in just sugarcoating it and saying it's okay. I said, this needs to be corrected. And so it came a time when they told me that I was being transferred and I was so angry. Because I thought about all the time I had spent, all the things I had done, all of the good that I had tried to do. And it seemed like nobody really cared. And so I was transferred to a precinct downtown. You never know God's purpose for you. And I went downtown and I was angry and I said, I'm just going to go down there and I'm not going to do nothing. Can't get in trouble doing nothing. And then I remembered something. I remembered what my sponsor had told me. Do what you're supposed to do and be where you're supposed to be. No matter how bad it is, do what you're supposed to do and be where you're supposed to be. Those young men and women were expecting a unit commander, and the citizens in that precinct were expecting somebody to be responsible. And so I went there and I did what I was supposed to do. I met a young man down there, and his name was Rusty. His name was Rusty Stallnaker. And I want you to know his name because of a significant point and change in time in my life. This young man, for whatever reason, bought into what I was trying to do down there. He helped me. He was one of the first people that bought into it, and he helped me. I was there for 6 months, and they told me that I was being moved. They said, you're being transferred again. I said, God, I ain't been here that long to get in that much trouble. They said, no, you don't understand. You're going back to where you came from. But this time you're going back as second in command of the entire zone. What a difference. I was getting ready to go to New Orleans and speak. I got a phone call that said that Rusty Stallnaker had been killed in the city streets of Atlanta. And they said that he's had a lot of supervisors. A lot of people have supervised him. And we don't understand it, but for whatever reason, his wife has requested you to speak at his funeral. I met another young man at that zone. His name was Joseph. Joseph was a sergeant. I had some interactions with this young man. I was transferred back to the zone where I just told you. And I was productive. And then Joseph ended up in the same zone that I was at. He had made lieutenant. And then in December of last year, he was promoted to the rank of major. And guess who he took with him to the Buckhead Precinct? I now am second in command of the precinct where the governor's mansion and all the good stuff is.
But the thing that I continue to do today, there's a passage in the book that says an alcoholic who has found a solution, armed with the facts about himself, in a few hours can win over an alcoholic. I hope tonight that I have spoken to you from my heart, and I hope what I have said has been received by you in your heart. And maybe before this weekend is over, we will continue to share in the fellowship of the Spirit. I told you about my grandson. Both of my grandsons' middle name is JC. I spoke to my son since I've been here tonight. Every time Tim came to my room, I was on my cell phone. And I spoke to my son because my son is having some difficulties, and I said, next Thursday, you and I will talk. So now I got a meeting with one of the guys that I sponsor. Same thing, we need to talk. And I do the same thing with people that I meet on a day-to-day basis, whether it's working, I work part-time for the Atlanta Braves, and I work at the Georgia Dome, and I try to do the same thing, especially when I'm out there with the Braves because I'm closer to people. And I try to, you know, sometimes people can see the God in you if you will allow it. The God in them will see the God in you. They look past the police uniform. Because sometimes when people see the uniform, there's this automatic thing that they put up. I got a little boy sent me a... I was out there at the stadium, and we just started talking, and he said, sir, would you like my hot dog? I said, that's sweet. And I sent him a couple of miniature badges that we had, and his folks sent me a picture of him and a nice card. Many days, people ask me to take pictures with their children, or they'll ask me would I mind going down and wishing one of their kids happy birthday on behalf of their Atlanta Braves. You know, that's not the same person, people that walk into Alcoholics Anonymous. My life has integrity and worth today. What I'm simply telling you, if you're new here today, if you do what's in the book, you listen to your sponsor, and you go to meetings, there is a life beyond anything that you can imagine. A few years ago, my wife and I sat in San Diego, California at the International Convention. And she was sitting on the bed just thumbing through. The Al-Anon had just printed this new book called How Al-Anon Works. She was thumbing through the book, and she said, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? She said, my story is in this book. The gifts that you have given me and given my family are too numerous to imagine. My little grandson, he came over the other day. His name is EJ. He's blonde-headed and curly, got curls, and he's slightly autistic. And he looked up at me and he said, Paw Paw, eat. He shares love from a different place. He has no eyes. About prejudices. His mind is not confused and clouded by the things that we deal with. And when he holds his little arms up and he says, I love you, it's a genuine love. I would have none of this if it had not been for you. And see, thank you so much for 16 years ago being part of opening the door for me. And thank you, Nashville, for helping me to continue that journey. Thank you.